Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
My name is Gary Thacker and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Following the recent hugely popular decade series focused on the 1970s, we thought it would be interesting to round out the series with a special edition of the Mount Rushmore debate, wherein we put three of the hosts of the series under the spotlight and asked them to nominate their candidates for a position on These Football Times' 1970s version of the Mount Rushmore monument. So, let me introduce the trio wearing the advocate's wig and gown today. In alphabetical order, we begin with Dave Bowler, who has rapidly become the doyen of Advocates Row, making his fourth appearance on a Mount Rushmore debate. So, Dave, given you've covered a run of episodes with an entire decade, did that make your choices easier or more difficult?
It's a good question. I think, actually, a lot of it was relatively straightforward. There's a couple that might be left field, perhaps, but mostly it was quite straightforward, I think.
Okay. Well, you know, we shall see as we move on. So in this episode, we're a bit like a Welsh football team with more than one David in our lineup. So next to Dave, and making his debut in a Mount Rushmore debate, we're delighted to welcome Dr. David Turner. And to keep things simple, I shall refer to Dr. Turner as David rather than Dave. So, same name as Mr. Bowler, David. Suddenly I want to give you the same question. A decade is a fair old spread of time to cover. Does that make your job easier or more difficult?
I was really pressed for time when I made my selections a couple of weeks back, and I selected them pretty quickly. And it reminded me of a passage in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, which is about intuition. And they asked a group of people to pick some artwork on intuition, what appealed to them straight away. And another group, they asked them to take their time and justify it. And the people who justified it a week later were less happy with the works of arts that were hanging in their house than the group who used their intuition. So, having been intuitively picking my players, I then went and did my research about a week later, and I'm delighted with the choices I've made. So a mixture of intuition and research afterwards.
Good stuff, buddy. Good stuff. I like that. So finally, sitting in the only non-David chair, it's a warm welcome back to Stephen Scragg. In a decade where his Liverpool team had such a string of success, it wouldn't be surprising if his selections carried a strong tinge of red. Without giving too much away at this stage, though, Stevie, was there a powerful Anfield pull to your musings on selection?
you might see a common theme throughout. I think pretty much, well, no, to be honest, all my selections, I think. But not just in terms of, I don't know, the team in question. I'd probably say the type of personality and you know, each individual is as well. Having looked at them, having picked them a few weeks ago, I look at them and think, yeah, there are players and a manager who are infinitely more 1970s, you know, that you would expect sideburns on and flares and all that type of stuff. But the ones that my selections are based upon personalities, people who have, I don't know, I think excelled across the entire breadth of the decade rather than just a kind of icon of a few years here and there, which, you know, that doesn't mean that the argument for those type of players who burn brightly for a short period of time, they're probably more 70s than my pick anyway. But I've kind of gone down a Liverpool kind of route that's, I don't know, kind of in keeping with just what they were at that point in time and will continue to be into the next decade, really. That metronomic nature. My choices are going to prove to be metronomic rather than spectacular, maybe.
I've gotcha. Well, there seems to be a theme to all three of your choices. I mean, if yours is sort of Anfield orientated, I think David's is a bit more sort of net spread wider, and Dave's is very much Dave Bowler selection. So I think at this stage, only I know the players that the managers each could have selected, and all will be revealed in good time. But I'm allowed to say this. There's been a few inspired inclusions and perhaps some surprising omissions too. And for the first time in a Mount Rushmore debate, I'm delighted to confirm all three advocates have got their first choices to argue for. So, but your way goes, guys. Don't blame me. It's your own fault. You made your selections. The only discipline I'm going to point to myself is that regardless of how I look at these players beforehand, my decision will be swayed solely by the strength of the arguments of the advocates. So let's get the ball out and have a kick around. So I'm going to start with you, Mr. Bowler, Dave, goalkeeper. Just going to get my sort of timing device ready, and I shall give you a second to have a contemplate. And I'm going to say you've got three minutes. Convince me, Dave, you're a goalkeeper. Go.
I haven't gone for somebody who necessarily goes across the whole decade. This is a moment of sort of iconography, really, I think. I mean, all through the series, all of us have waxed lyrical about the FA Cup, its importance. And I think you've got to represent Rushmore. The FA Cup has to be represented on Mount Rushmore. I mean, it could have had Ronnie Radford or Ray Crawford, Chris Kelly, I suppose. But for all the greatness of those achievements, it's Sunderland winning the FA Cup 1973 that matters the most. I think of all that, it encapsulates why that's perhaps the FA Cup's greatest decade, the 1970s. The cup final is a showpiece. It happened live in front of the nation. The country stopped. Everybody sat and watched it. And the medals got handed out at the finish. It's the one that counts. And 73 was second division Sunderland against Leeds. Consistently the most impressive side in England for a long, long time. Probably the most consistently strong in the first half of the 1970s anyway. And second division Sunderland, they couldn't possibly win. Leeds were going to retain the cup, all sorted out. It's rare that the winning goal isn't the iconic moment in a cup final. But in this cup final in 1973, it's a save. Sunderland are already 1-0 up. Ian Porterfield has scored midway through the second half. There's a crossfield ball from Leeds, who are battering Sunderland by this point. Reaches the far post. Trevor Cherry, full-length header. It's virtually in the goal already. But Jim Montgomery, who is my choice, if you hadn't already worked it out, full length to his left, pushes it away. Fantastic save. But what follows is greater still. Peter Lorimer's following up, the man with the hardest shot in football, as they used to say in the 70s. 6 yards out, he drills it at goal. David Coleman's already saying Lorimer makes it 1-1. But Jim Montgomery somehow picks himself up, gets across, gets hand to it, pushes it onto the crossbar and away. And that's it. The cup is won. Yeah. If that goal goes in, one apiece, Leeds go on and win the FA Cup, but they don't. And Sunderland win the cup and it's Bob Stowe going into all that stuff. And as I say, Mount Rushmore is about icons and iconography. And, we've talked about the legends of the game in these Mount Rushmores up to this point. Jim Montgomery was a good, honest goalkeeper. But they deserve their moment as well. And that's where you should go on Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
I've saved you 15 seconds.
A typical Dave Bowler. Yeah. No, I mean, I love the icons. You can win the icons. And, as you said, Mount Rushmore is a bit of icons. So it's a bit of a test here for David and Stevie to follow. David, I'm going to come to you next. You've got to beat that with your goalkeeper starting there, buddy.
I'm picking Dino Zoff for his consistency, but also for his calm dignity and his leadership. He's the only Italian to ever win the European Championship and the World Cup. They bookended his career in 68 and 82. He was goalkeeper of the tournament at both and captain and oldest man to lift the World Cup in 82. According to the International Federation of Football History and Statistics, Zoff's the third greatest goalkeeper of the 20th century behind Yashin and Banks. But in terms of his heyday, he would be the greatest in relation to the 70s, I would argue, where the majority of his top-level performance was. Italy's undisputed number one for the national team from 72, and he played in 3 World Cups. 385 games for club and country in the 70s alone, not including domestic cups. His nickname is Il Monumento, the monument. There's got to be a bit of luck there, right? But that was more about his status than his stature. He was rejected as being too small by Juve at 14, but he came from a rural farming family and his grandmother fed him 8 raw eggs a day and he grew 33 centimetres. Juve finally recruited him at the age of 30 in 72. He won 6 Serie A titles with Juve, 4 of them in the 70s, 2 Coppa Italias in the 70s, the UEFA Cup in 77, but his annus mirabilis is probably 1973, when he won Serie A, runner-up in Coppa Italia, European Cup final and the Intercontinental Cup, and was second in the Ballon d'Or for his near treble with Juve. A number of records he had in Serie A, oldest player, 41, most appearances, 570, and amazingly, the most consecutive appearances for Juve, 332 on the spin, never missed a game, even when he played some games with broken ribs. 1972 to 74, he set the still existing record of 1,142 minutes without conceding in international football. He also had, from 75 to 80, 8 clean sheets and a record 784 minutes without conceding across European Championship qualifiers and tournaments. He retired as the most capped player for Italy, 112 caps in 83, and was chosen as the most outstanding Italian player of the last 50 years as part of UEFA's 50-year celebrations. There's been a hormonal explanation from researchers for home advantage, and goalkeepers in particular have higher levels of testosterone before home matches because they've got a specific area to protect. Zoff said, "I felt in charge of a place in particular, a place I had to protect and in turn protected me." If his position made him feel safe, maybe that was why he exuded calm in the most pressured of situations and was able to provide leadership and organisation from the back.
Okay, buddy. Now, this is one of the reasons why this episode is so fascinating. We've got a guy who's pinned an argument based on one moment. Two saves, but one in one moment. And pitched against that is a guy who's dripping in silverware and awards and honours throughout the decade. Stevie, where are you going to go with your guy, matey? Away you go.
Well, entirely unpredictable on this one, but it has to be Ray Clements. The romance of Jim Montgomery, yeah, totally get it. You know, the scientific, you know, nature of Dino's off, totally get it. But Ray Clements, the one and only Ray Clements, missed only about half a dozen games throughout the entirety of the decade after displacing Tommy Lawrence in March 1970. Won 4 league titles, an FA Cup, played and lost in a further 2 FA Cup finals, won 2 European Cups, 2 UEFA Cups, reached the League Cup final, turned out at Wembley itself 30 times across the breadth of the decade, 9 times in a Liverpool shirt, conceded just 16 goals throughout the entirety of the 1978-79 title-winning campaign. The most naturally gifted English goalkeeper of all time. There's been hard-working ones, but I think the most naturally gifted ones is Ray Clements, and I'd throw Gordon Banks into that. Banks was one of those where he mixed style and skill, but with consummate hard work. It's not to say that Clements didn't work hard, but Clements started as a kid as an outfield player, and that showed in his goalkeeping, in becoming, you know, Liverpool's not first sweeper keeper, but the benchmark for all sweeper keepers. You know, Alison Becker, you know, is rightly lauded at this point in time of his career at Liverpool, but he's still held accountable to the record of Ray Clements. Just the most elegant of shot stoppers as well. His save, a crucial save in the 77 European Cup final, that was the pivot upon which that game turned at 1-1. It can never be downplayed. His importance to Liverpool's successes throughout the 1970s was just beyond the recognition that he got. You know, he just served club, country admirably. And, you know, his clean sheets record, not just in 78-79, There's an iconic picture in a Liverpool programme about the hundreds of clean sheets he kept. At the Kop end, he's on a ladder hanging clean sheets on the crossbar as a testament. You know, the type of image that health and safety wouldn't allow an Alison Becker to do anymore. But Ray Clements, though, an icon, just a magnificent all-round goalkeeper and just the most successful, without shadow of a doubt, the most successful goalkeeper across the breadth of this decade. Ray Clements.
Great. Okay. Stevie, you almost used your full allocation of time there, 2:58.12. So, you know, you sort of filled the gap well there, mate, as many of the goalkeepers just discussed did. So, to give me a little bit of extra thinking time, I'm going to sort of just throw this back to you guys for a second. So, Dave, if we discount Montgomery, you know, if we can sort of put your dark glasses on and the dazzling the silverware these two guys, Zoff and Clements, accumulate in their careers, who would you go for, given the arguments posited by the guys?
They are two great choices. I mean, I picked Dino Zoff, as you might call, for the European Championships and lost. So, I could quite happily see Dino's off go up there as a consolation prize. Ray Clements, I mean, I agree with Stephen. Hugely underrated, Ray Clements, because obviously because of, you know, Peter Shilton then became the monolith after that for all those years. But I always felt Clements was a better goalkeeper, maybe apart from that one season when Forest won the league. But I always felt that Clements was a magnificent goalkeeper. Changed the nature of the job. You can't really ask for more than that. I'd probably just about go for Clements, but either way.
Okay. David, coming to you then, matey. The iconic moment of Montgomery or the silverware and record of Clements, where would you go if you discarded Zoff, mate?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that, you know, Dave's gone for an iconic moment and described the moment really well and contextualise it. And Steve's gone for a whole decade of consistency and dignity in performing at high level. So it's a little bit comparing apples with oranges, isn't it? But, you know, I guess I'd go with Clements for, what would I describe it as, sustained excellence across a period. And I take Dave's point about iconic moments. I remember that final very well and watching it. And it's a magic moment. But I guess if I'm going to put someone up in stone, I'll go for Clements for his sustained excellence.
Okay. Stevie, same question to you. If I can sort of persuade you to reluctantly put Ray Clements aside for a moment, Zoff or Montgomery?
Zoff's I'm a huge admirer of Zoff, without a shadow of a doubt. I think he's the greatest of continental goalkeepers in my eye. On a 70s context, however, you know, Montgomery, if you think 1970s goalkeeping moment, if you're just saying one flashpoint moment, it's that save, that double save by Jim Montgomery up at Wembley in 73. I would have to nod towards Jim Montgomery. He'd save it, though. I'd nod, he'd save it.
I think it's a good point David made that, you know, Clements and Zoff are very similar, but comparing that with Montgomery's situation is a bit like comparing apples and oranges. And I think if I went between the two medal-strewn goalkeepers, I think I'd probably be persuaded by David's arguments about Zoff. You know, not discrediting Clements because it's a fairly close argument, but I think the iconic moment, I'm going to go with Jim Montgomery. Just because I think it's the iconic moment, and as Zoff and Clements played in, you know, the top teams in their countries, Montgomery played for a second division team and got them over the line to a trophy. So I'm going to go with Jim Montgomery on that. So that's my goalkeeper decided. David, I'm going to come to you to first pick with your defender, mate.
I'm going to go with Franz Beckenbauer, Der Kaiser nickname. That's the Emperor. And he was certainly an elegant, imperious player and a commanding leader. A versatile defender who started as a midfielder but dropped deep to find more space and freedom from markers from which to launch attacks and then single-handedly invented the modern libero or sweeper position. By the start of the 70s, he was already an attacking sweeper and a leader. He was Bayern's captain. He was captain of the national team from 71. West Germany placed third in the 70 World Cup when Beckenbauer famously played on with a dislocated arm in a sling, because they'd used all their subs, I think, in the game of the century in the semi-final against Italy. He won the German Cup in 71, three league titles with Bayern successively, 72-74. He was the first captain to ever win the European Championship, 72, the World Cup, 74, and the European Cup. And he was also the first to win three European Cups consecutively, 74-76. Between 70 to 77, he never missed more than one league game per season for Bayern. We've already said that Bayern won three league titles and three European Cups successively. In all that time of success, Bayern never had a recognised number 10 playmaker because they had a deep-lying quarterback in Beckenbauer who could launch attacks and orchestrate from deep. He had 103 caps for West Germany, 68 alone in the 70s. He's the only defender to win the Ballon d'Or twice in 74 and 76. He kind of semi-retired at the end of the decade in 77 to New York Cosmos, but still managed to win two soccer bowl titles before the 70s were out. In summary, I'm picking Beckenbauer because he's efficient, classy and reliable, like a finely engineered German car.
Wonderfully put. And a nice summary at the end as well. Be it the BMW of defenders. Stevie, I'm going to come to you next, matey. Your defender, matey. Where you go?
Well, I'm... not Veerin again, away from Anfield. I've opted for Emlyn Hughes on this one. I thought long and hard on this one, but there's so much, sounds like utter favouritism, but there's so much even for Liverpool fans to dislike about Emlyn Hughes. His personality could be Marmite. His politics could be highly questionable. But as a football player, he was a groundbreaker. He was monumental as part of both, two eras of Liverpool. He was central midfielder of massive repute, prototype Steven Gerrard. And it was 73-74, although he covered the position earlier than this. And he'd started out as a left-back at Blackpool, signed by Liverpool, converted to a central midfielder. It was his drop into central defence in 73-74 on a permanent basis, having covered the role a couple of times in previous seasons, that was the catalyst to Liverpool becoming European Cup winners, extraordinaire. That expansive notion of defending, the move away from Anglo-Saxon thuggery and to ball-playing central defenders coming out of defence with the ball and instigating attacks, and that is still prevalent to the Liverpool way to this very day with the likes of Virgil van Dijk. It's the style, the substance. It was the determination, the bravery. Twice a European Cup winning captain, which, I don't think any other player has done that in European Cup or Champions League era as far as an English team is concerned. Player of the year in 76-77. He would even go on to move on to Wolves to complete the set of major medals, apart from a Cup Winners' Cup that eluded him. But something as a tournament, I think he only played in twice, I think, two seasons. Four league titles, an FA Cup, a couple of other FA Cup finals, the UEFA Cup finals, had the temerity to take the Anfield captaincy off Tommy Smith, went to loggerheads, and in a way his feud with Tommy Smith is an admirable thing as well at times, because Tommy Smith wasn't the angel. No one professing to be an angel on the pitch, but there were question marks over Tommy Smith's temperament off the pitch as well. But yes, Emlyn Hughes, it's the, I don't know, the silkiness of the player, but the steel as well, and the fact that he paved the way for the likes of Alan Hansen to come through as well. Incredible, Emlyn Hughes, marvellous player. Left back for England as well for the vast majority of the first half of the 1970s, which made him my choice.
Ran out of it there, Stevie, so I'm just counting the last 3 seconds of that. Dave, we've got themes with David on the continent, and a theme with Stevie on Merseyside. Is your theme similar? Is your goalkeeper? Away you go.
Slightly different this time. It is about consistency over the decade. It's been interesting listening to Stephen talking about Liverpool's change, because my choice is Lawrence Valentine Lloyd, who should be on the mountain for the name alone, really. A bit of Anglo-Saxon thuggery, possibly, about Larry Lloyd's football, but a great player, I think, over the course of the 1970s. I don't think you can discount that. I mean, he started at Bristol Rovers, and then Shankly brought him to, I suppose, essentially sit in the centre defence in place of the ageing Ron Yates, that kind of thing. Played in the FA Cup final of 1971. And went on to play for England that summer. So obviously he settled into that role pretty quickly at Anfield. 72-73, didn't miss a minute of the 54 games that Liverpool played as they won the league and the UEFA Cup, which is a magnificent achievement. As Stephen then says, he sort of missed the latter stages of 73-74 with injury. Phil Thompson steps up to replace him in the Liverpool central defence, forms that partnership with Emlyn Hughes that we've just heard about, and Liverpool go off in a slightly different direction, as does Larry Lloyd. In 74 they sell him off to Coventry, where he had a couple of years still in the first division. October 1976 he signed by Brian Clough for Nottingham Forest, so it seems like a step back at that point, back off to Division 2. 1976-7 he wins promotion with Nottingham Forest. 1977-78, he wins a second league title with Nottingham Forest and the League Cup. 1978-79, he wins the European Cup with Nottingham Forest and another League Cup. and a Super Cup, forming, well, shall we say, a rudimentary partnership, perhaps, at the back with Kenny Burns. Not Phil Thompson and Emily News, but I suppose there's more than one way to skin a cat. And those two do go on and win a European Cup as well. So, I mean, if you just look at what Larry Lloyd did in that decade, he won two league titles, he won two league cups, he won a European Cup, he won a UEFA Cup, he won the Charity Shield, he won the Super Cup, he even won the Anglo-Scottish Cup. I think that's a fairly sound argument for any fella to be, if you consider it much more. And he did it with different clubs, even more exciting. So, Lawrence Valentine Lloyd, there you go.
Good one. A classic Dave Beryl up front there. Love it. Okay, then again, give me a little bit of thinking time. I'm going to give you guys for a little bit of guidance. So, David, if we put the Kaiser to one side for a moment and compare two Liverpool legends and obviously Lloyd at Nottingham Forest as well, who are you going for, Hughes or Lloyd?
I think Lloyd's a great shout, you know, for the different clubs and the achievement at different clubs in that decade and the consistency across that decade. Emily News is massive, of course. But I think, as Stephen alluded to, you know, he comes not without some baggage in terms of some of his behaviour and some of the way he wound people up. I understand he wound people up even on the Liverpool side, right, Stephen, some of the stories. Larry Lloyd, I think he's the one that still bemoans the fact that he never got the thumbs up from Clough. You know, Clough used to give the players the thumbs up. So there you have this hard man who's like really upset because he didn't get a thumbs up from Clough. So I'd go with Larry Lloyd, I think, for the across different clubs and for the Anglo-Saxon thuggery. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Good one, David. Good one. Stevie, putting Mr. Hughes to one side, what are your thoughts?
Beckenbauer, you can't go any further. You know, he is the godfather of defensive, you know, football. You know, and I think with Beckenbauer, he's just one of these, you know, individuals. He speaks of the 60s as well, doesn't he? And into the 80s, and then his management of taking West Germany to World Cup glory. Just an omnipresent figure in football for, you know, at the very sharp end for a quarter of a century, and, you know, milled around it in dictatorial terms with the DFB for another 20 years to come. You know, incredible. I do have to nod to David, to Larry Lloyd, however, as well, because, you know, I think he was second on my suggestion list, second or third, I can't remember. You know, and to do it with Liverpool and then to walk away and do it with, you know, Forest via, you know, a spell at Coventry, where he kind of, I don't know, a lull, shall we say, at Coventry. He still played football with Coventry, but, you know, it was a backwater compared to Liverpool and what he would go on to do with Nottingham Forest. Very unique in that respect. So, Larry Lloyd.
Yeah. Dave, coming to you. If we put Mr. Valentine back in his envelope for a second, Hughes or Beckenbauer?
I've got a great deal of time for Emily News. I thought he was a magnificent player, and he was kind of the driving force, the emblem of that Liverpool team through a lot of those periods. But Franz Beckenbauer, just a one of the greatest players in the history of the game, you know, magnificent footballer, national team, Bayern Munich, the whole shebang. And clinchingly, I don't think he ever kissed Margaret Thatcher. So there you are. That's your friend's best player, isn't it?
I couldn't say a name, Dave. I couldn't bring myself to say a name.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, you know, that's a key factor in my judgment as well. Yeah, so okay. First, I'd say, I mean, when I saw Larry Lloyd, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be, you know, a sort of an icon Forest thing. But I didn't realise the sort of collection of medals he'd actually had as well. So, you know, he's got a few trophies in his pocket as well. I think anybody going up against Franz Beckenbauer is on a hard nothing basically. And, you know, Hughes is a ball playing centre back. Beckenbauer's a ball-playing centre-back par excellence. And it's a fantastic argument from Dave when he said that all the time in those years that Bayern didn't have a number 10 because they got Beckenbauer playing as quarterback. So I've got to go with Beckenbauer. I think it's a no-brainer. So it's a great argument, well put eloquently by David. So Franz Beckenbauer is the defender. So we're going to move to the middle of the park now. Stevie, I'll be in with another red. Away you go.
Yes, in red they are indeed. It's Ian Callaghan. 857 appearances for Liverpool across virtually 20 years, almost 20 years for the club. One yellow card across that period of time, part of England's World Cup winning squad in 1966, played one of the group games, won an England recall at the age of 35 in 1977 under Ron Greenwood, a player of the year 1973-74 at the age of 32. This having seemed to be on the way out in 70-71, his most injury-disrupted season. Very rarely missed a game in any other of the campaigns he played, apart from the very tail end of his career at Liverpool. Massively adaptable, you know, hugely influential in this Liverpool side. Brought back into the European Cup final team in Rome in 77 at the age of 35 to be the pivot upon which Terry McDermott and Steve Highway could be the arrows moving forward to support Kevin Keegan. Started out on the right-hand side midfield, effectively a right winger, not a flying winger, but a tricky kind of player. Wonderful, ability to cross the ball. That reinvention that tends to go forgotten about him. You know, a lot of reinventions of players at Anfield that go talked about, be it Ray Kennedy, who switched to left side central midfield from centre forward. Hughes, as we've discussed, Phil Thompson, another one. Ian Callan's shift to central midfield put years on his career. Now, at the age of 31, many thought he was finished, and he was still pulling on a Liverpool shirt and kicking the ball around at the age of 36. He swept from second division to champions of Europe with the club. He travelled the whole, the whole distance. He outlived. He went through virtually the entire stretch of Bill Shankly's reign at Liverpool. Went on into Paisley's reign. Massively influential. So many players were signed purportedly to replace him. You know, Brian Hall was primed to replace him. He saw off the challenge and made Brian Hall shift positions. Peter Cormack, he kept Terry McDermott at bay for 2 years, only eventually replaced by Graeme Souness. We talk about consistency. This is the man of consistency. Ian Callaghan, wonderful person as well, wonderful individual, great footballer.
Well put. Then again, it's another red, which is perfectly reasonable considering the success of the part of the season in a decade. Dave Bowler, where are you going, buddy? Be your midfield. Go.
Leeds United were the best team of the first half of the 1970s, without a shadow of a doubt. And the architect of that team, the brain behind it, was John Giles, who I think was the thinking man's footballer, albeit that he was a savage little bugger as well, and he could look after himself when the need arose. I think he was like Danny Blanchflower a decade earlier, or people more recently like Pirlo or Zidane, in that he got three great attributes. I think the obvious one is he could deliver a football to its recipient over any distance with incredible accuracy. Slightly more subtle than that, but more important, was the fact that 99 times out of 100, he was delivering the right pass to the right person at the right time. And that's pretty extraordinary, because even the really, really good players rarely get that right more than probably 70% of the time. I think the third, though, is the most important attribute of the lot. It's vastly underrated, but it's very rare. John Giles always wanted the ball, and he was always available for it. And there's plenty of very, very good players, even some who are considered great, who only want the ball when the sun's shining. He wanted it every minute of every day because he thought he was the best player on the pitch. And, that's an egotistical thing, I suppose, but it's also a humble kind of thing. It's a way in which to be a service. The thing with John Giles is he had a second act on a partisan level, in that he went to the Albion in 75, take over as player-manager, and he won promotion in his first season there, and completely changed the way Albion played the game. Much more studied game, a passing game. And he was the one that began to create that side that impressed in the late 70s that we talk about. He bought Laurie Cunningham, he bought Cyril Regis as basically his final act of his time at West Brom. But again, it was him as a player. I mean, people like Tony Brown at West Brom told me that John Giles was the greatest player he ever played with. And he was, 35, 36 at that point. But he was still able to run every game that he played in. And he tried to leave after winning promotion and was persuaded to do a second season, by which time he left. And that, I think, is another reason why I would have him on Mount Rushmore because he's one of the few that had the nerve to point out that football directors were mostly cretins and walked away from it. So there we are.
A nice payoff there, Dave, to sort of close out the argument. And I come to you next, David, obviously, if you want midfield playing. It's interesting that with your defender, you've got a converted midfield player. And for your midfield player, I think you've got a converted defender, don't you, mate? Away you go.
I was going to say to you, we'll have to talk about the influence of that on us, because it tells you a lot about us, our choices. Okay, let me tell you about my midfielder. So I've got a left field with Paul Breitner. He had his career predominantly in the 70s. He played from 70 to 83. Played at top level in every season of the 70s and was in his prime, 19 to 28 years old. Originally a striker, as we say, he converted to a very free-roaming right-footed left-back during the early 70s and then converted again to a multi-dimensional and versatile midfielder. He's one of the most effective players of his era, but he also had, and this is why I've picked him, productive synergies with other players, with Beckenbauer and Vokes in defence for West Germany, with Karl-Heinz Rummenigge in midfield and attack for Bayern. So great players make other great players around them, make other players around them great. He was a serial winner supreme in the early 70s, German Cup 71 with Bayern, five consecutive league titles between 72 and 76, three with Bayern, two with Real Madrid. European Championship in 72, European Cup and World Cup in 74, when he scored the equaliser in the final in 74, not because he was a designated penalty taker, but because he was nearest the incident, apparently. Spanish Cup, and thus the double in 75, 48 caps for West Germany, despite withdrawing from the squad in 74 and only being persuaded to return in 81. I like my midfielders to have a bit of personality and be fluid and versatile. Breitner's edgy and adaptable, like his politics. He was influenced by Mao and Che Guevara and looked like a Cuban revolutionary. But he advertised for McDonald's, joined a team associated with a fascist dictator, Franco, and shaved his beard off for another lucrative advertising contract. Maybe that positive split personality is helpful in midfield, though, right? A midfielder's got to switch often between attacking and defensive mindsets, and he's got to provide an effective link between defence and attack. I watched some footage of Breitner the other day, hard tackling and clearances off the line, converted defender. But he also had many assists for other players and a fierce long-range shot. I know we're out of the 70s here, but he returned to Bayern and captained them to their first league title since he'd left 6 years previously and was made German Footballer of the Year in 1980. And in 82, he appears in the World Cup final and is only the second player, I think, after Pelé to score in two World Cup finals. I give you my left field choice, Paul Breitner in midfield.
Excellent. Excellent stuff. Excellent stuff, guys. So they're three fascinating subjects. So it's like, get the extra thinking time, Stevie. Callaghan, massive loyal to Liverpool. But if you can sort of cast him aside for a moment, Giles, Breitner, totally different characters. Where would you go given the arguments?
Both fantastic arguments from the two Daves there. But I do have to lean to Paul Breitner. I saw him wide-eyed as a kid playing for Bayern Munich against Liverpool in the 81 European Cup semi-final. That blizzard of hair alone that just looked like a swarm of bees from a distance. You know, he truly was a magnificent player. Yeah, in so many ways, un-Germanic. You know, but and the hipster points as well for his year at Eintracht Braunschweig.
Yeah,
as well, I'd throw in there. You know, and also, you know, trendsetter for kind of like being able to make that shift to Spain as well. No, not long after ban on foreign players had been lifted as well. Just an incredible player. Both great choices, but I'd lean towards Brighton myself.
Dave, what are your thoughts, buddy?
Very, very tough again. I mean, Brighton was a fabulous player. And, you know, I echo all the things that David and Stephen have said about Paul Brighton. Ian Callan was always one of those players I always had as a favourite in the 70s. Very much in the same way as Chris Lawler, I suppose, at Liverpool. Very similar kinds of characters, very unassuming, just got on with the job, played every week, were always brilliant, never had a bad game, all that kind of stuff. Very, very tough to pick between them. But I mean, I think somebody like Callaghan is emblematic of the 70s in the sense that there were a lot of teams had a player who went through the 70s and played, you know, all the way through, one club man virtually. Obviously, he went away right at the tail end of his career. But I think just for that, he sort of sums up something about the 70s. So in the end, I'd probably just have to go for Ian Gallan. Only just, mind you.
Fair comment. David, if we leave the German out for a second, looking at two more, British, obviously Giles is Irish. Giles or Callaghan, what are you thinking, mate?
I started the decade as an Arsenal fan, and you always have a grudging admiration for people in the opposition camp, right? I love Lorimer, but I love Giles as well. Great midfield player. I guess, you know, we're comparing apples and oranges again, but I think Callaghan's just such a faithful servant, isn't he, to his club? And, you know, he's not only consistent, but kind of reinvents himself a little bit as well when he comes back late in his career. So I think I'd go with Callaghan, because I think perhaps Giles's contributions are across the 60s and 70s for me. But that's on a technicality, right? And it's very close.
Okay. I think it's fascinating that we've got, obviously the international success as well as domestic success of Breitner. If you're looking at medals and who was the best player, you know, you think there, you know, that would be a strong argument. Giles, perhaps less of a long time, shall we say, is a key factor. But I think that's where Callaghan wins out as the sort of consistent feature all the way through the decade. And so, you know, I'm going to agree with you what, you know, Dave and David said. I'm going to go for Ian Callaghan. I think, you know, he's the almost an epitome of the 1970s Liverpool team. And, you know, given the success they had as well, I think Callaghan's my man for the midfield. But there again, I think there's a fag paper between the three of them. So we're moving on to the forwards now. And we've got some classic choices here. This is going to be an absolutely brainstorming one. So, Dave, you've got to sell it with your best pitch here, buddy. You've got a great choice, though. Away you go.
Definitely not one who went for consistency over the 1970s. I'm talking about somebody really on the basis of about 3 years' worth of work. But it's the greatest footballer that the UK has ever produced and ever will produce. And obviously, it's George Best. It has to be George Best. I mean, he probably had three seasons in the 70s, but they were perhaps his best three seasons. 23 goals in 69-70, 21 in 70-71. But the 26 in 71-72. The tragedy is that at that point, he was carrying Manchester United on his back. Law and Charlton were on the decline. The team as a whole were on the decline. Matt Busby had gone. There was all the mess in the manager's office that we've talked about in the series. And there you are, you got George Best at his absolute peak. And he was let down. I mean, he had his heart broken, I think, by United's failure to give him the team that deserved to be a part of. And yet he blew up, of course he did in the 1970s, as we all know. But think of all the golden moments from the 70s, that goal against Sheffield United from that ridiculous angle. There's the six goals against Northampton Town on a cabbage patch. There's the disallowed goal when he took the ball out of Gordon Banks' hands for Northern Ireland. I mean, there's even the one in America for the LA Aztecs that he scored in the 70s. I mean, I saw him play in Jeff Astle's testimonial when he was on one of his sabbaticals from football. He was about 3 stone overweight, and he was the best player on the pitch by a mile. He was George Best. I mean, what the hell else do you want to say? I'll fill the rest of the time, but he was George Best. I mean, he blew up. I mean, again, we talked about 70s Mavericks. How much more of a Maverick do you want than George Best? I mean, the absolute Mavericks Maverick, wasn't he, really, I suppose? Nobody's ever made football look a better sport than George Best. At all, even in his demise, he was the emblem of everything that 1970s football was about. When we talk about the flair side of it, you know, the great players, the excitement, the thrills, all of that sort of stuff. I mean, when it comes down to it, George, I mean, I was probably at the right age, being born early 60s, for George Best to be, you know, like a Beatle or whatever it was. But George Best isn't about facts and figures, you know. George Best is why you fell in love with football, and that's why you should be on Rushmore.
Yep. That's a good one, Dave. It's a good one. This is absolutely top echelon argument. These guys. So, David, I should say. I've got to try and keep a sort of neutral stance here, because you're going to talk about one of my favourite players of all time here. So, away you go, mate.
Okay. No pressure. Right, so Johan Cruyff. While Mikkels and Cruyff had developed the foundations for total football in the 60s, Cruyff's greatest achievements as a footballer were firmly in the 70s. From early 70-71, when he returned from injury and somebody had already got the number 9 shirt. He wore the iconic number 14 shirt. I'm picking Cruyff for his goal scoring, e.g. 193 goals in 245 appearances in his first Ajax spell, 64-73, but also for his many assists. So, e.g. 180 matches for Barca in the 70s, 60 goals, 83 assists. League titles, 70-72, 73 with Ajax, 74 with Barca. Domestic cups, 70-71, 72 with Ajax, 78 with Barca. 3 European Cups on a trot with Ajax, 71-73. World Cup runner-up, 74, but also player of the tournament then. Ballon d'Or, 3 years, 71, 73, 74. But I would argue 71-72 was a significant season for him, part of the most globally dominant club side in history. Continental treble for Ajax, Euro Super Cup and Intercontinental Cup. Cruyff was the top scorer in that season in the European Cup, the Eredivisie and the KNVB Cup, and he scored both goals in the European Cup win over Inter and still didn't win Ballon d'Or that year. World transfer fee to Barca in 73, where I believe he was classed as cattle to get around some financial rules. He helped Barca win the league for the first time in 14 years, despite arriving a couple of months late with Barcelona lowly placed in the league. On the way, they beat Real Madrid 5-0 away. He had 48 caps for the Netherlands, 33 goals. He was North American Soccer League Player of the Year in 79 with the Los Angeles Aztecs. He was voted European Player of the Century by the International Federation of Football History and Statistics. A leader on the pitch, orchestrating others and pointing to spaces. Total football is all about the exploitation of space. He was known as Pythagoras in boots for his precise angled passes. A revolutionary figure, the total footballer. A team orchestrator, a creative playmaker, a fluid footballer. Technical ability, decision-making, vision, acceleration and dribbling. He was intuitive, creative, and he played with beauty and style. A Cruyffism is that he said, you have to be in the right place at the right moment. Cruyff as an attacker in the 70s is firmly in the right place at the right moment.
I mean, I'm trying to keep sort of a neutral stance, but that was brilliantly argued there, David. Stevie, we've got two magnificent icons of 70s football. In George Best and Johan Cruyff, as they say, you know, in the challenges. What you got, buddy? Away you go.
I've got the player that George Best declared to be the best British footballer of all time in Kenny Dalglish. The 70s, from a Liverpool perspective, I get why so much of a Celtic period falls under the radar in a similar way to kind of, it's a reverse of Keegan leaving Liverpool. But, you know, at Celtic, he was absolutely biblical. 4 league titles, 4 Scottish Cups, Scottish League Cup, goals galore. Scored 111 league goals, 178 in all competitions for Celtic. Should have reached a European Cup final with them. 2 semi-finals, came into the side. After he was on the periphery when they reached the final in 70. Watched from the stands, drop into midfield. A similarity in that respect to both Best and Cruyff, and that, you know, he could drop back into midfield, he could push up front. He was just utterly wonderful. I mean, the thing with Dalglish is that he goes on to encompass so much of the 1980s as well, that, you know, his 70s era kind of falls under the radar a little bit, but his individual terms, his best football was played in the 70s. Collectively, he did so much more in the 80s, and obviously as player-manager and manager. But in the 70s, when he was at his raw, youngest best, he was unstoppable. Often played as the point for Celtic up front. Got, you know, his highest numbers of goals in a Liverpool shirt in individual seasons would come in his first 2 seasons in a Liverpool shirt. You know, once David Johnson came through, you know, he started to play that a little bit deeper. So the goals kind of like wore off a little bit. Like they ebbed a bit, but, you know, his influence increased. But across the 70s, you know, he was goals. You know, he went on to be the first player, and even if he's the only player still, to score over 100 league goals, both north and south of the border. I'm cutting him off at 1979, though. We're not going into his 80s as part. You know, this, I'm just going to argue with 70s. And it's that European Cup final winning dink over Birger Jensen at Wembley. The Adidas Tango spinning through the air. You know, his spin away and over the advertisement hoardings. just absolutely everything. Majestic play, my favourite all-time player. I always said that as a Liverpool fan, you're allowed a different favourite player than Kenny Dalglish, and you are, because when you're the king, you don't need to be, a favourite player. So, but yeah, you know, Kenny Dalglish, just, you know, to replace the legend that was Kevin Keegan as well. Stunning.
Time's up, Stevie. Okay. I think what we've got here now is we've got three players here who could easily have won. I think what's going to decide for me, and I promise you I'm not being biased, is that, you know, best is 60s, 70s, and Dalglish is 70s, 80s, and the key era of Cruyff was very much in the 70s and the success. So, you know, I mean, I'm really not being biased here, but I think I've got to go with Johan Cruyff. I think he's just he's an iconic thing. If Best had played for more of the seasons in the 70s, say it was 7 or 8 years in the 70s, could shift his career back, that would be. I mean, he was an icon, obviously, but I think it's got to be Cruyff. So yeah, I'm going to go with the Daves and Davids and say Johan Cruyff. So now, having done the players, we're now going to move on to managers. And it's interesting to say that of the three choices, you've all got your first choices, but the patterned in the second and third choices that you chose were sort of somebody else's first choice, somebody else's second choice. But before we go, I'll go into that. I want to give you each an opportunity to tell me what your thinking was behind your choices. So I'm going to start with you, Mr. Bowler, Dave. Tell me what your sort of rationale was in your sort of selections.
I mean, it'll come up as well in the final one. By and large, it's an emotional reaction, I think, more so than technically, you know, who achieved most or whatever. Maybe not in the case of Larry Lloyd, but it's just those moments that sort of stick in your head from the 70s. Those things that you can run through your mind without having to get a YouTube, I suppose, more than anything. And that was definitely the case, obviously, with Montgomery, with George Best, John Jaws to a certain extent, and certainly with my manager as well. It will be of no surprise to anybody at all when he comes along.
No, I mean, you're fitting right into your pattern you're going to go with. Dave, I'm going to come to you. Well, so what do your choices say about you, Dave, before we move on to your manager?
I think what they say about me is I like a mix of dependable players and maverick talent. So, you know, I've got my dependability of Zoff and Beckenbauer. I've got the edginess and the maverick talent of Cruyff and Breitner. I think it also says that I like, as a coach, that I like versatility in players. All of my players, apart from the goalkeeper, had played somewhere else. So that gives them a multi-dimensionality, I think, above other players. They were all leaders. I think they were all captains. Zoff was a captain, Beckenbauer was a captain, Breitner was a captain, and so was Cruyff. So I like a leaderful team.
True enough. That leadership did eventually lead to Cruyff leaving Ajax at the end. Good point. Yeah. Stevie, aside from your players all wearing red, what was your rationale for picking it? Did you go just for success, it's a sort of flippant comment, because there's a lot of players there who are not necessarily the best players in the era, but some massively. Players who would be massively appreciated by fans, I think. Is that fair?
These are all the players and individuals I grew up on. Those that I watched at a formative age, but also kind of like the stories that my dad told me and the players that he respected. And, you know, and there's not a maverick amongst them, but that's because, you know, my dad's football, there wasn't a maverick in the side. The closest we came to was that very iconic flirtation with Frank Worthington, and the interesting way in which his transfer fell through, and the glove puppetry that goes on about the real reasons behind that. But Liverpool were a collective. You know, they were you know, the most socialist football club throughout the 1970s. In that respect, is that it was all about the collective. It wasn't about the individual. You know, that doesn't mean that there weren't skilled players. There were, you know, Steve Iwai was a wonderful flair down the wing. But, you know, this was all about, you know, a collective of players pulling together in the same direction. You know, you only have to listen back to Shankly's speeches and his interviews and, you know, his form of socialism, not a party, political socialism, was kind of like everyone in it for everyone else as well, and pulling in the same direction, and everyone having a share of the spoils. And that was just what I grew up on, was that ethos. And, you know, when I sat and picked my selection, I sat back and I thought, this is kind of, it's Wilson's Liverpool, Harold Wilson's Liverpool, rather than Ted Heath's Liverpool, or anything to do with that. It's just the way that, I was brought up, really. I always admired the flair, and that's the thing. Totally, even I can't remember all the choices, the second and third choices that are made for this, and I rest sure that they weren't all Liverpool players. I know I've referenced Larry Lloyd earlier on, but like from a strikers, I threw in, who did a throw in as alternative, Bob Latchford, who was the other side of Stanley Park, Malcolm McDonald. And again, it was on the basis of just how prevalent they all were throughout the entirety of the decade and the service that they gave, rather than that kind of, flashpoint and romanticism. And I buy into all that. And I think from a Liverpool supporting perspective, there is huge amounts of respect for all those players. And it's why they always got applauded at Anfield. Why goalkeepers will trot down still to this day towards the Kop end and be applauded by the Kop. And it's a respect for everyone else's football teams and players as well. But it's all right for other teams to have those. What we have is our collective. We admire what you've got, but our collective is what will go on and lift the trophies. You can have your fantastic, skilled players, but we'll take the pot home.
Okay. We're going to move on to the coaches now, just see if that sort of ethos that you've just mentioned, guys, sort of continues into the selections for your coaches. David, I want to come to you first, and we've skipped around the continent, your choices, but I think you're returning to a very British sort of coach. Well, that's not a very British sort of coach, but at least a British coach anyway. David, away you go.
Brian Clough was at his bombastic best in the 70s. I want to make it clear that I'm selecting Clough with Taylor. They're one of the greatest managerial synergies in football. Together, they were much more than the sum of their parts. A career-ending injury for Clough meant he had more time to learn about management, and he came across a superb, ameliorating foil in Peter Taylor. Initially, he was the youngest manager in the league at 30. Greatest success at Derby up to 73 and Forest from 75. Derby had been in the second division for a decade when he took over. They were promoted under Clough in 69 and they won the top tier for the first time ever 3 years later in 72. 73, Derby reached the semi-final of European Cup. Switching to Forest, they were promoted in 77 under Clough and they won the Division 1 title in the very next season, again for the first time ever. Two consecutive League Cups, 78-79. Two consecutive European Cups, 79-80. In 78, they set a then record of a 42-match unbeaten run. In 79, they were runners-up in the league to Liverpool. In 79 also, they were European Super Cup champions, defeating Barca. I think the feats with Derby and Forest, two provincial clubs languishing in the second tier with little previous history of success, was incredible. That's a major reason I'm picking him. Only four managers have ever won the English top division with two different teams. None of them did it with teams from such a lowly starting position. So what we have with Clough is the transformation of two clubs in the 70s. But also, Clough and Taylor had the transformation of players too. They converted misfits and rejects into stars. An unfit, overweight John Robinson into a European Cup winner. A reserve midfielder, Tony Woodcock, into a 42-cap England international. The drinking, gambling centre-forward Kenny Burns into Footballer of the Year in 79 as a centre-back. Clough himself, unique, unpredictable, abrasive and exuding confidence. He was the first charismatic, media-savvy celebrity manager. Team played attractive on-the-deck football and he emphasised good sportsmanship was needed from his teams. And he's obviously known as the greatest manager England never had. To paraphrase Clough, he may not be the top manager of the 70s, but he's in the top one. He insisted on being called boss. He was a bit like a socialist dictator. Despite Clough's reputation, though, as a hard taskmaster, several players played for him at different clubs or re-signed with him at a club. Savvy recruitment, e.g. Shilton. Clough and Taylor brought together the ingredients. They spotted and nurtured talent, and they made them believe. J- John McGovern said he convinced the players that we could be the best. And I think what I need with my other selections, I need a manager who's going to be the biggest ego in a team of egos. And I think he fits that. By the way, before we leave, can we think about the McGovern mystery? Why was he never capped for Scotland? He only started playing at 15. He played under Clough and Taylor at 16 at Hartlepool's, and he followed Clough to Derby, Leeds and Forest. What a ride, but not a single Scottish cap. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Well done, Max. You got 3.1 seconds left, David, so you judged that brilliantly, mate. Well done. And a great argument about Clough. I mean, these three choices here again are very much like the strikers are fag paper between them. Stevie, we've had four choices so far, and you're on Anfield. I'm thinking you're staying in Anfield for this one as well, buddy. Away you go.
Consistency has been the theme throughout, and I'd be mad to change that right now. A toss of a coin, which one to go for, but I've opted for Bob Paisley. Only managed for half the decade, but at the same time, the choice was based on who's your doctor, who's your top of the pops presenter, and Bob Paisley is all of those for me. You know, he is top of the pops, he's Doctor Who, he's the Liverpool manager, and you know, he's my default setting. What it is as well is that, you know, revolutions, not down in them, and there was a revolution that I'm sure Dave might pick up on very soon, that, you know, played its part in this as well. But evolution is harder to spin than football revolution. You know, Bob Paisley took over a massively successful side. The 74 Cup final side was Ray Clements, Lawler, Lindsay, Hughes, Thompson, you know, Lloyd out, injured, Callaghan, Cormack, Hall, Highway, Keegan, Toshack, playing a 4-4-2, wide midfielders slash a winger in Steve Highway. And he totally altered that within 2 years. You know, the change in Ray Kennedy into that left-sided midfielder of world-class repute, bringing in Jimmy Case, pinching the midfield, having the full-backs who were already attacking full-backs push on all the more, the phasing out of Lawler and Lindsay, the arrival of Phil Neal, who played left-back and then moved, you know, to right-back, the continuation of the ball playing central defenders, the sweeper keeper, the implementation of Dalglish, the arrivals and an eventual absorbing of Terry McDermott, the signing of Graeme Souness, the unearthing of Alan Hansen, the replacement of Kevin Keegan with Kenny Dalglish, the resurrection of David Johnson, you know, and that's before you even get to the trophies, you know. Three league titles, two European Cups, two UEFA Cups, and have been right-hand man to the top man for the first half of that decade. He'd learned from the master and then took his own spin on it in a completely different direction in so many respects. He would roll into the 80s and there was more to come. I would totally get there are others that would signify the 70s more than Paisley. But the man was just an utter genius, and did his work in a completely different manner. English football's Lobanovsky.
Time's up, Stevie. It's I guess Paige is the sort of guy you could go on talking about for, 3 hours. I mean, yeah, because of this sort of status and the success he had. So Dave, I'm coming back to you then, buddy. We've had Clough, and we've had Paisley. And I think you're going to complete the triumvirate, aren't you, of the great managers of the 1970s. Way you go, buddy.
I suppose I'm going to fall foul of the fact that he did a lot of his work in the 1960s and before, but obviously it has to be Bill Shankly. Stephen's already done most of the talking for me, really little left to say. the greatest football manager of all time, without the slightest shadow of a doubt. In as much as not only was he a great football manager, he also built a great club that continued after he went, which has not very hasn't been the case pretty much anywhere else. You know, you think of when Busby or Ferguson left Manchester United, there was no Manchester United succession thereafter. But there was at Liverpool. in the talking just the 1970s. I mean, he'd rebuilt the team in no time at all. I mean, the 70s started, couldn't have started worse with the defeat at Watford in the FA Cup. Tommy Lawrence, Chris Lawler, Peter Wall, Jeff Strong, Ron Yates, Emily Hughes, Ian Callaghan, Ian Ross, Alan Evans, Ian St John, Bobby Graham. 12 months later, but in the FA Cup final, he's found this fella, Ray Clemens, in goal. Alec Lindsay's at left back, Larry Lloyd's at centre half, Steve Iway, John Tusher, Brian Hall, Kevin Keegan sitting in the crowd watching the game. He's reinvented that entire team inside 12 months. They go and win the league and UEFA Cup double and all of that stuff. But I mean, all of that's just window dressing. I mean, it's Bill Shankly. This is the point. The point of why you should be on the meeting is Bill Shankly. I mean, as a kid, I was absolutely besotted with Bill Shankly, even more so than George Best. The fact that Bill Shankly would be on Football Focus or Match of the Day talking and doing an interview was better than watching the game, frankly. I mean, it was all about, you know, I mean, he was funny, he was smart. And then you go back to all the stuff that Stephen said a few minutes ago about the socialist principles of how Liverpool played and all the stuff that he talked about, which basically, you know, I would say my political mentors are Bill Shankly and Tony Benn, which is a fairly strange pairing, but I think that is pretty much how I've grown up ever since. But coming back to really where I started from, apart from the fact that he's Bill Shankly, and no person in the history of the world has ever loved football more than Bill Shankly did, which means he has to go on the mountain, obviously. But coming back to where I started with Jim Montgomery, the other great image of the 1970s for me is Bill Shankly on the touchline, his final game as Liverpool manager, 1974, the puppet master directing the traffic from the bench. That is the 1970s. That'll do.
Great timing, Dave. Great timing. 2:56.01. Great stuff, yeah. And I know listeners can't see us, but we're all doing the Shankly puppet master hands waving on the Wembley bench as Dave was. That's how iconic the guy was. So we're going to ask you guys to do the impossible, make my job a little easier. Dave, I'm going to come to you first. Pick between two Liverpool legends, buddy. Shankly or Paisley?
Well, I mean, all three of these ought to be on a Mount Rushmore of their own, right? They're all absolutely iconic. I think what's so impressive about Liverpool in the 70s is the handover from one legend to another and the making of a new legend who takes it even further in such an unlikely way. So that handover, that transition, that kind of almost hereditary thing that they have there, where one builds on the culture of the other, and takes it somewhere even better, is just amazing. But I'm arguing against myself here, aren't I? but again, they're very different characters, right? But to pick between the two, I think I'd go with Paisley, because although Shankly is you know, a complete cultural architect, he does a lot of that in the 60s. He lays a lot of that ground in the 60s. It was so unlikely that Paisley would take it even further than Shankly had in terms of achievements. And so for him to do that, I think, and to reinvent excellence when excellence was already there, is why I would go with Paisley. But they're all icons.
Yeah. Okay. Stevie, Clough was the bête noir of Liverpool for a few years. Would you go with him or would you go with Shanks?
It would go against the grain to go anything other than Shankly in this respect. I totally respect everything about what Brian Clough did for Derby County and what he did for Nottingham Forest. It's unique. It's amazing. It's incredible. And, you know, and he stretches that breadth of the 70s undeniably. You know, I totally get why Clough would be picked for this, because Shankly and Paisley split the atom of the decade between the two of them. You know, they come as a pairing. You know, they come separately. But Shankly, you know, it's what Dave said in kind of like, you know, creating a club. You know, Liverpool, even to this day, when you strip away all the excesses of the modern game, you strip away the veneer and the laminated nature of it, at its core soul, it's still the club that, as far as the supporters are concerned, it's still the club that he built. It's still in his image. That inner core, The beating heart of Liverpool Football Club is still the one that was constructed by Bill Shankly. And yeah, you know, that image of him on the touchline, the 74 Cup final, you know, the 74 Charity Shield, when he got, you know, people, supporters on the pitch kissing his feet, and you know, he doesn't want that, but you know, it's the adulation that he drew, you know, that reverence it still echoes now, you know, and for me, it has to be Shankly. You know, I think that the split in the difference here is that Clough, you know, we spoke of difficult personalities and questionable personalities, and there's always those shadows about Clough. I'll never forgive him for his, you know, the setback of the Hillsborough campaign and the damage he did, you know, with his comments in the 90s. Is suspect treatment of Justin Fashioning, you know, and things like that. And that's why I'm always at odds with Clough, is that I can, you know, totally respect everything about what he created on a football pitch, but there will always be an unease at that personality and the shadows that, you know, the skeletons in the cupboard. So part of that as well as just kind of like everything being painted red throughout this podcast from my corner.
I think that's really interesting. And I think, you know, I selected Clough with Taylor, and I think Taylor was the better angel of Clough's soul, you know, and he curbed his excesses and allowed him to flourish at his best. And without him, I think Clough was a loose cannon and Clough was a flawed genius without Taylor. But with Taylor, they were absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, everything about Clough there, when you look at just the managerial side of everything that he did, even down to, you know, his 44 days at Leeds and that mad period at Brighton and stuff like that. There's just so many layers to it all. You know, I totally get why this would go Clough's way.
Good point well made, David. Good point well made. Dave, I'm going to come to you then. So we've got the iconoclast, almost the iconoclast in person, Mr. Clough, with Taylor in brackets. Or we have the Paisley era of European domination. Where are you going, buddy?
Well, it's a fantastic argument made by David and by Stephen. And I've got a huge amount of time for both Paisley and Clough. Unfortunately, Gary, I'm not going to be able to do this, because this would be like denying Christ three times before breakfast. I mean, it's Bill Shankly. It's Bill
Shankly. Okay, that was succinct, you know, but yes, it's to the point. And in fairness, I mean, it's one of those things where you sort of use the two words, say the name, drop the mic, walk off, case closed. Okay, I think Clough is an iconic character in so many ways, but perhaps his success with Forest was almost a high point, and then there was disasters that followed. And things. I mean, Clough, what he achieved with Nottingham Forest was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But comparing to what Paisley achieved with Liverpool, bear in mind Paisley picked up a successful club and then took it to crazy high levels, unprecedented levels for British football, was perhaps even more astounding. But I have to say, Steve's comments about Shankly and how he's perceived by the Liverpool fans was sort of strangely persuasive against his own argument, against his own guy. And I think the question is, would Paisley have been successful with Shankly being there first? And I think I'm going to go with Shankly, because I can't think there's more a more iconic manager in the history of British football than Bill Shankly. So Shankly completes the quintet for me. He's going to be the manager on Mount Rushmore. So we've got goalkeeper, Jimmy Montgomery, defender, Beckenbauer, midfielder, Jim Callaghan. God, I'm in politics here. Ian Callaghan. Johan Cruyff as a forward. Bill Shankly as the manager. Guys, thank you very much.
I'm just glad that Thatcher didn't make the team there. I was worried for a second.
Jim Callaghan. Good God, Gary. I mean, Jim Callaghan wasn't even a left winger. Ian Callaghan was. Jim Callaghan wasn't even a left winger. Strange enough. So, Dave, had a good time.
It's been great fun. The whole 1970s thing that we've done has been a delight, to be perfectly honest, over the last 2 or 3 months. It's the the Hotel California decade. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. That's the 1970s. It's been fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
Boom, Dave. Boom. Boom. Well done, pal. David, thank you for coming on board, mate. In your first Mount Rushmore debate. I hope it won't be your last. You've had a good time.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, I've really enjoyed the 70s stuff and, you know, just justifying your choices and going back and looking at those players a little bit more, looking at some footage of, having an excuse to look at some footage of Brightner yesterday. You know, it's a lovely, refreshing look back at things that inspired you as a youngster when you started playing and eventually ended up coaching and things like that. So, like I said to you, I think it's like a Rochblatt test, right? It's like that ink thing where you look into the ink blot and you find out something about yourself. So I think it's been quite interesting in that way.
Good stuff. Stevie, enjoyed it, buddy? I know it's Liverpool era, but, you know, aside from that, have you enjoyed the Mount Rushmore debate?
Oh, it's been a joy to do. And as Dave said, you know, everything that we've done throughout all the 70s content of late has just been absolutely fantastic to do. You know, the decade that fashion forgot, but, you know, not when it comes to football.
Good stuff. Fashion forgot, football remembers. So on behalf of listeners, I want to thank you guys for doing the 1970s series and inviting me on for one episode as well. That was great fun. Been a terrific series, guys. So thank you very much. And, you know, more power to you for bringing that great decade of football back to life for us. So that was our Rushmore debate on the 1970s. So listeners, now it's over to you. We'd love to hear some feedback from you. Did the guys make the right choices and convincing pitches for their selections? Who did we miss out that should have been considered? And of course, did the judge make the right decision? Spoiler alert, of course I did. I always get it right. Seriously, that would be great to hear your thoughts on Twitter. Just tag @thesefootytimes and hashtag TFTMRD. That's TFTMRD. And let us know what you're thinking. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Love Podcast from These Football Times. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Love, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.